K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. And with the help of Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, Mel and Dick try to organize this rabble called a technical net. We gather the clan every Sunday night. The technical net has existed for 27 and a half years. So every Sunday night for 27 and a half years, ham radio operators get together and they discuss their favorite hobby. And we teach each other how transmission lines and antennas and transmitters and receivers and propagation and the 26 different kinds of ham radio, how does it all work? The schools don't do enough of a job of teaching that. We ham radio operators teach each other. And obvious by the kind of mail that Mel and I get, a certain percentage of the population out there is for appreciating it. And if you want to listen to past technical nets for the last 5 years, a very enthusiastic guy named Mike Perry, KC2NJI, has recorded them all and documented them as to what subject is discussed during each couple of minutes or so. And you can find all of those recordings by going to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. You go there and you can download 1 hour reels at a time, choose the date, choose the month, choose the year, choose the subject, and there's a lot of information there. It's a resource. There's also specific articles where Mel has given us a talk on the Smith chart or on how decibels work, and those are separately documented if you want to listen to just those particular instruction periods. A person signs into the technical
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And there's the thing that you shouldn't be doing, that I just did. We have to interrupt the carrier, something like once every minute or minute and a half, if not portions of the machine time out, and therefore decoupling to the east machine. There's a 146.85 machine, which is called the western machine of Limark. There's an eastern machine at 147.375. They are linked together. Also, there's linking to Echo Link and IRLP. And if we don't drop the repeater long enough for listening to that beep in between our conversations and interrupt every minute or so, various portions of the system crashes and has to be reestablished. And Eric, our man who runs the machine, Kilo Echo 2 Echo Juliet, will say some strong, salty language to you. He puts it diplomatically, but don't get him mad. Let me drop.
2 Hotel 1.
Now, so Joseph W-A-2-R-Y-Y signed in last week, and we didn't get to him. So as the rules of the game work, Joe is going to be number one on the runway tonight. Are other people ready to sign in? Give me your call letters and name. Please, only the people who have a question or a comment for the net sign in. After 27 years, we don't need to listen to a list of 50 names saying, I'm here and I'm listening. We accept that. This particular repeater covers the tri-state, let me drop, covers portions of the tri-state area of northern New Jersey, southern New York, and southwestern Connecticut. And as such, by now we assume there are people there. Otherwise, these nets that last 4 hours every Sunday night for the last 5 years wouldn't exist. There's obviously a thirst for knowledge out there. Mel gets an awful lot of emails from guys who find the technical net on their scanner or by word of mouth, start listening to it and say, hey, those guys are having fun. They're learning. I want to join that. And a certain percentage of those guys go out and get a ham radio license. We get some very nice emails from them every year. It's quite encouraging. So, we've already got Joe. Anyone else to sign in who really has a question or a comment, give me your call letters and your name. Try not to forget your name, because I'm very forgetful. A typical sign-in would sign like this. Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee, Mel, and yes. So do we have any check-in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
November 2, X-ray Juliet, November, Wesley, and yes.
Does have a curfew, but a question.
November 2, Hotel Oscar, York, yes.
Okay, we had a few doubles and triples there. I got Steve N2MDP, Wesley N2XJN, N2 Hotel Oscar. Mr. Hotel Oscar, I should know your name. Please tell me.
Sure, this is George, November 2, Hotel Oscar. Hi, everybody.
Very fine, George. And wait a minute, I didn't wait for the beep.
This is...
He has a curfew, so if there's any way you can help us with that.
Okay, I heard the set of call letters, and I heard curfew. Give me those call letters one more time, please.
Whiskey 2, Echo, Echo, my name's Jet.
And he has a curfew with a question.
Okay, quite a noisy signal, but we'll get you in there, Jesse. Whiskey 2, Echo, Echo, Oscar, Jesse with a curfew, and he's going to go right after Joseph, the B2RYY, who is the first guy signed in from last week. Okay, so once again, we've got Joe, Steve, Wesley, George, and Jesse. Who else did I miss?
K2YO, have a housekeeping issue we need to discuss first.
Okay, Bernie, go ahead with your housekeeping issue.
The good news is last week we started off with 9 IRLD connections and 7 people on Echolink, including somebody from Mexico, Guadalajara. The bad news is within about 20 minutes we had blown them all off. We dropped the links 14 times last week. We really need to redefine, instead of waiting for the beep, we really need to wait for the squelch tail. If you wait for the squelch tail, that will guarantee that we're not dropping. Every time we wait for the beep, that doesn't guarantee that the link won't drop.
Yeah, I got a nice, very nice letter from the man in Guadalajara, which I replied to already. Alrighty, so I think you're saying we don't just wait for the beep. We wait for the machine to thoroughly drop. Wow. Okay. We'll have to try to keep doing that. Okay, Joseph, you're number one on the runway. The B2RYY, wait for the machine to drop, and go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I don't think you have to have the machine drop, but I'm going to tell you something. I'm listening in two places at once, on 2 meters, and I'm listening on my IRLP link. There's a significant difference in time delay. When you hear the courtesy tone to what I hear on the IRLP, there's a significant difference in time. When you drop and wait for the beep on 2 meters, and it may seem like a 1 second between the you dropping the carrier and getting the beep, there's only a quarter second delay on IRLP, and that kind of timing issue is what's timing at all of these repeaters on the 9126 reflector. You are going to have to triple your time on 2 meters. Do you hear the beep? Wait 2 more seconds and then talk. If you don't do that, you're going to drop everybody on the reflector. That's what's happening.
K2YO.
Go ahead, Bernie. Bernie told us that not to wait just the 2 seconds, but wait until the machine really drops. Go ahead, Bernie.
Joe, we've made some modifications. Eric put some modifications into the controller. We're trying some new things. This is a problem we're well aware of, and we're making changes week by week by week, trying to get this under control. So we're doing what we can. But definitely, if you can wait till the tail drops, that definitely resets us. This week we've got some changes. We're going to see how those work. It's not going to help the Echolink people that can't get in. That's going to require us to get Echolink on W2BL. But we're working on these things, trying to get some solutions.
And just if a person like myself, who tends to be long-winded, Bernie, for a person who's long-winded, I should interrupt my speech how often? Once every minute, once every minute and a half. And when I do, I make sure everything resets. I've got to wait not beyond, not only just the beep, but wait for everything, the carrier to completely drop. So how soon should I interrupt my long-winded speech, Bernie? K2YO, K2RIW.
I'm not sure what the exact timing is right now, but let's try do it every minute and 20 seconds and see how that works for you.
Okay, so we all have to look at our watch when we talk. A few of us, me included, get wound up in a subject, and if nobody stopped us, we would talk for 5 solid minutes, only taking 2 breaths, if you know what I mean. We can't do that. You got to look at your watch. Okay, so Joe's got a real question, I'm pretty sure. We're going to wait long enough for the squelch tail, and then every minute and a half or minute and a quarter, Joe, make sure you do an interruption. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
Okay, good evening, Dick. W-A-2-R-Y-Y. My question was, it's a DTV question, going back to that subject who's haven't approached in a while. Very recently, I've been picking up a carrier on Channel 2, RF Channel 2. I haven't been able to identify it because I don't have the right antenna to be able to identify it, but I do hear a carrier on the air, and I can see it on my DTV converter, on all my converters in the house from where I am. I don't know what or where it's coming from, but if you listen on 54.3094, there's a steady carrier all the time, and my converter indicates there's some sort of digital carrier on RF Channel 2. And I wasn't aware, I don't know if CBS is doing this or this comes from somebody else, but it's on there all the time. Maybe Eric might have some insight on something like this, or somebody else is broadcasting in the metropolitan area on that particular RF frequency now. That's my question.
Not interesting. Back in the old days when Channel 2 really was being used for analog television, MTSC standard, 54 to 60 megacycles, a 6 meg channel, the actual video carrier was on 55.125. Now that you're listening to a carrier at 54.3094, which is the new pilot tone frequency for digital high-def television, or at least digital television, it says that somebody is transmitting a digital signal there. I'm going to pass it over to Eric. If he happens to be on channel, KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, to answer that if he's listening. If not, if Eric does not come back, please pick up Joe. Joe, you just pick up, so to speak, after that drop, and tell us how strong is the signal. In other words, I think you're probably using a scanner or a spectrum analyzer with a relatively narrow resolution bandwidth in order for you to pick up that 54.3094. I'm going to guess that the signal is not strong enough for you to demodulate it, and or it is strong enough, and just there's nothing there. It's just blank. So KE2EJ, if he's there. If not, W-A-2-R-Y-Y. K2RW on the TechNet, and we're going to wait for a drop.
Okay, the carrier I'm receiving on my R7000 off a monitor antenna, vertically polarized, is approximately about S9, S8 to S9. It's a steady-state signal. It's not something I'm picking up from that's coming in via DX or whatever you want to call it. Out of the area. This is carrier's been on for about at least 2 weeks that I know of, and my TV just cannot pick it up because it's not strong enough to make the converter activate on it. But I can't really tell if there's an RF digital signal on there or not. I do hear some noise on the receiver when I'm in the AM mode. If I go a little higher in frequency, it seems maybe the S meter actually go higher, but I really can't tell if this is actually a DTV carrier or not. But it seems to be that's what I'm picking up by going onto the pilot frequency. I also pick up something on channel 3 that's pretty much consistent too on 60.3094, but that's much weaker in level continuously than this other carrier. This other carrier just appeared recently. It's pretty much up there. It's almost as strong as some of the other DTV carriers that are coming out of New York City. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, fascinating. I know for a while, starting, I guess it was February of 2009 when we flipped over to digital television. For a period of time, Channel 4 was having a old-fashioned analog signal describing how to set up the cables and the converter and whatever for digital television reception, so that for the people who had nothing but analog, they had at least a source of information and get completely left in the code of the cold, but unfortunately they had no further real television programming, so to speak. I'm guessing by now that has been abandoned. When it comes back to you, Joe, you can correct me on that one. I'm guessing there are no New York City-based NTSC analog television signals telling you how to switch over from analog to digital television. So we are totally cut off from analog, except for what might exist on cable TV, or what might exist by way of the ham radio operators doing over-the-air broadcast. I had the impression not very many ham radio operators have transmitted any digital television yet, but I guarantee that's going to change. Over to you, Joe, for any comments further on that. and then we'll be pretty soon switching over to Jesse. 782, Romeo, Yankee, Yankee, K2LIW in the TechNet. Wait for the drop.
Okay, I'm hearing another repeater in the background. It must be the one from Connecticut. Okay, very good. The only channel I get that's analog, which is not a high-power broadcast channel, something on channel 60, some sort of shopping channel, but other than that, there are no other channels I can that I can pick up from the New York City direction that are analog anymore. Everything is digital, totally. I think all the stuff you talk about on channels 2, 4, and 5, or whatever that was broadcast, the messages about switching to DTV, I think that lasted maybe 30 days, maybe 60 days at maximum, but they're all totally gone now.
Okay, very fine, Joe. And, now that you've been doing quite a bit of snooping with your scanner, your R7000 icon, I think it is. I've got one of those also, and I should do some listening. I gotta repair some of my antennas so I can get better sensitivity also. And as well as this great project of mine, I'm gonna put up a steerable high gain antenna to do some digital television DXing. I've got 100 feet of tower on 300 feet of land, and it would be kind of fun to do that and see what kind of reception from far off distances is possible. Good work, Joe, and we'll see you down the log. We're going to switch over to Jesse now. I hope that the signal is not too noisy. W82 Echo Echo Oscar. I believe I met you briefly at the Ham Radio University. And if I don't have you confused, Jesse, I think you're one of the guys that had made one of those ground plane antennas. And maybe that's what you're talking to us with. You got it, Jesse. W2 Echo Echo Oscar. Wait for the beep. Now wait for the drop. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, it's your request.
I'm going to give it to my dad to ask him a question because I don't have his voice. So here's my dad.
Hey, Dick, and good evening to the net. W2CYK here. Actually, the funny thing is that we're doing some experiments for his science fair project with the antenna design from Ham Radio University with the ground plane. And, if you remember, my grandfather, W2LH, used to do a antenna demonstration using incandescent light bulbs to show the current loops and use fluorescent light bulbs for showing the voltage loops on the antenna. All right, so the net of our question is we found this very interesting phenomenon that if we only have one leg of the incandescent light bulb attached to various parts of the antenna, it still lights. In other words, it's like an open circuit. It's a completely open circuit. So we're trying to understand why the incandescent light bulb lights very brightly at the, oddly enough, the voltage loop, medium brightness in the middle of the quarter wave vertical, and at the current loop, with one leg attached, lights very dimly. Over.
Okay, very fine, Jesse and Father. Before I get into your question, Eric broke in. Eric, you have a message for us, KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I have one question. Did you hear me come over Echo Link, or you didn't hear me at all?
I heard you say your call letters once, just before Jesse picked up. Does that answer the question? Go ahead.
Yeah, that did. Actually, I gave you a whole long thing going Echo Link, but over Echo Link, but obviously somebody else got there too fast. All right, well, we'll get back to it later anyway, but continue to answer his question.
Now, Jesse, you've got me a little bit confused, Jesse and Father. You called it an incandescent lamp. I'm wondering if it really is a neon lamp, but you're talking about something like an NE2. When you put a neon lamp and or a fluorescent lamp near a radio circuit, only making contact to one terminal, you will get lighting. A truly incandescent lamp, like say for instance a 25-watt old-fashioned light bulb, just one terminal of it touching, is that what you're saying? And if you were interrupting the antenna and putting that incandescent light bulb in the middle of that wire where you interrupted, therefore the current is flowing through the bulb, I'd sort of understand that. And I guess there's a slim chance you really are using the right words, that your incandescent lamp does glow. And as you probably know, there's an inert gas put inside of a modern-day incandescent bulb, simply because the filament, let me drop it. The filament tends to continuously outgas because it's running at the, 3,500 degrees centigrade, some really high temperature. That's why it's giving off light. And so the tungsten of that filament would continuously be boiling off and coating itself on the outside, on the inside of the glass of the light bulb itself. So they put an inert gas in there which slows down that process. And I think the inert gas could be something like argon. And argon and neon with a voltage on one side will give you lighting. So let me double check now that it really is an incandescent bulb. I'm kind of curious how many watt incandescent bulb, what brand name, and so on. Or is it one of these modern-day compact fluorescent tubes? So what was the nature of the bulb that you made one contact with in various positions? And then I'll give what I think is an answer. W2, Echo Echo Oscar. That's the person who really asked the question. You've got it. K2LIW in the TechNet.
W2EEO here. Control off of Bob here at the mic. All right, Dick. This is a GE18 Tango 3 incandescent bayonet-style bulb, and I assure you that this bulb is older than the hill. This was taken out of one of my grandfather's junk boxes, and if I was to guess, I would think that this bulb is at least 30 years old. At the very least, maybe 40. So I assure you it's an incandescent. I can't be sure that there isn't an inert gas in it, because I don't know the characteristics of this bulb. I attempted to look it up, but it's just a very interesting phenomenon. You know, I would expect a very bright lighting at the current loop if both were attached. At the current loop, we are getting a very, very dim light with only one leg attached. Midway, in other words, at an equal mixing of current and voltage loops, with one leg attached, it's extremely bright. And then at the very end, where I would think that there would be predominantly voltage loop, it's pretty bright, like, midway. So, kind of an interesting phenomenon, and we were perplexed, and I looked at the clock and said, it's 8 o'clock, you know what, let's go ask Dick. Over.
WB2HWW in a comment.
Yeah, 2OAO to comment also.
Okay, we have to wait for the drop. Howie and Joe in that order. We're going to get to you after I give a couple of comments. And I am guessing that it isn't the filament itself that is giving off this light, that you've got a kind of a glow around the filament. Give me a quick break on that one, Bob. If you look with a magnifying glass at the bulb when it is giving you this light, is it the pure filament itself that looks like it's lit as if you had voltage flowing through the filament, or do you see a glow around the filament, and particularly a glow near the glass of the bulb itself of this Bayonet GE18 Tango 3? So describe the light itself, its color, and its location within the glass envelope. Over to you, Bob.
I assure you, it is the tungsten glowing, right?
Dick.
Okay. fact that it's working on one terminal, the fact that it gives you maximum brilliance in the center, not at the tip, and much dimmer down at the bottom, I can explain that one. Let's see what Howie's got to say first. WB2HWW, wait for the total tail to drop, Howie, and watch your watch, K2LIW. Howie, you're going to have to go to your high power mode. I'll go over to Joe first, and we'll come back to you. Joe, WHURYY, go right ahead with your comment, and wait for the thorough drop.
WHURYY. I've noticed a similar phenomenon as what the other gentleman is talking about, with the bulb glowing very, very dimly by servicing RF power amplifiers of various levels. And I've noticed by doing the same trick using a bulb as a detector or detecting device, as I go back to the actual collector of, say, like an RF output transistor and go very, very close to the collector itself, I will notice exactly the same thing happening, where you have no actual DC connection between the bulb, the frame of the bulb, and the, you know, the ground of the chassis, only your fingers, and just use the center contact as a touching point to the circuit itself. As you go back to the actual collector of the device itself, you'll see the filament just barely, barely glow. And I'm talking about using, say, a 6-volt bulb of 140 milliamp current to draw something somewhere in that vicinity. And as you go away from the collector and go towards the antenna jack to the different circuitry, you'll watch the bulb actually increase in brilliance quite a bit. You actually get to the antenna jack, and it's lit up quite brilliantly. So I do know what the guy's talking about. And I've also noticed that the bulb will actually glow even if your fingers are not touching the metal frame of the bulb, the outside connector. Just through simple inductance and capacitance, you will get the bulb to still glow with the filament of the bulb itself.
Very fine, Joe. So you've seen the phenomena also. I'm pretty sure we'll go over to Howie and find out how often he has seen it. I've got about three explanations as to what's going on. One, many people have done this with a fluorescent tube, and what's really going on is you're getting capacitive coupling. Even though it looks like there's nothing but open air between you and the end of that fluorescent tube, you've got your hand on one end and the other end is near the RF circuit, and you'll see light. And it's the capacitive coupling that's doing it. Second thing that's going on is that we've often discussed in the last month or so, often, twice, we've discussed balloning devices, and you're seeing a beautiful example of why a balun is required. If I take a piece of coaxial cable, bring it to the center of a normal horizontally polarized dipole up in the air, common sense would lead you to believe, hey, that dipole is thoroughly floating. It's in some cases 70 feet in the air. There's no earth nearby. The fact that my coaxial cable is an unbalanced transmission line, meaning that the real voltage is between the center conductor and the inner surface of the outer tube of the coax cable, and in theory there's no RF voltage on the outside of the coax cable. So you would think that, the antenna would just simply rebalance itself. No problem. It's a floating structure. Let me drop. In reality, each half of that dipole references itself to a kind of ground. And the word ground here has got a peculiar meaning. You could be testing your dipole on the end of a great big long stick. You're an astronaut. You're floating outside of the space shuttle. You're in orbit. You're really in free space. And on a great big long pole, you're doing the dipole experiment. And you'll find out if you don't use a balancing device, I mean, that antenna, in that example I'm giving right now, floating in free space, is thoroughly away from anything that could be called at first ground. You'd be 160 nautical miles in space, floating freely, and you might be a quarter of a mile behind the space shuttle when you're doing the experiment. And you would find out that each tip of the dipole references itself to a ground which is the rest of the universe. If you don't put the right kind of a balancing device in there, the antenna, in trying to balance itself to that ground, putting that word in parentheses, will force voltage to come back down the outside of your coax cable if you're not using a balancing device. So, even though you only made contact with one terminal of that light bulb, the other terminal is seeking a kind of ground. RF behaves that way. And I still think there's an inert gas in there that's doing that, although you've made it super clear that you believe the filament is doing all the lighting. I think if by way of a thermal imaging camera, you measured the real temperature of the filament, you would find that it's a lot colder than the amount of light given off would indicate. I think it is the gas around the filament that is doing the lighting from the RF effect, capacitive coupling to a real direct contact to one terminal, capacitive coupling to the universe for the other terminal. So if there really is a potential...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
There really is a potential difference across that light bulb. RF behaves that way. In the early days when Mel and I used to build HF circuits, like with an 807 tube, it was an awful lot of fun to resonate the plate tag circuit without a shield around it and bring a pencil in your hand nearby. And you could draw a nice blue arc about half an inch long off the plate cap of an 807 tube into that pencil in your hand. Again, the other end of the pencil at the RF frequency is seeking a kind of ground, although it's really finding very good with your hand wrapped around the wooden portion of the pencil and the capacitive coupling from the conductive lead through that wood into your hand, you could say was one terminal, and the sharp point of the pencil getting near the plate cap of the 807, which had probably an 800-volt sine wave of, in my case, 3.5 megacycles on it when I was drawing that arc. A fun experiment. So RF is peculiar stuff, as you see. Let's see if Howie's got some further comments on this. K2WB2HWW. Make sure you wait for the drop. K2RIW. Okay, I'm not hearing Howie in there right now. I know you haven't had a complete explanation of it, Bob, but you've had the beginning of an explanation. To do that with a neon tube, or any kind of a tube containing an inert gas, if you started doing experiments with your compact fluorescent light bulbs, with any of the neon bulbs you've got, with any of the voltage regulator tubes you've got, like an AO7 or AO2, I think it is, anything that's got an inert gas inside, you put RF on just one terminal, you'll get peculiar lighting effects. And so let's hope that sometime in the future we find out what your father's GE18 Tango 3, what kind of a light bulb it is. It sounds like you haven't found it in any of the reference manuals so far. Maybe it's something that was manufactured in the 50s and it ceased manufacture. Fascinating question. W2 Echo Echo Oscar with Bob, KQRIW and TechNet. Wait for the drop.
A W2EEL. Okay. Yeah, I'm very much aware of exciting a gas filled, the molecules in a gas filled tube. In fact, we have a couple of gas filled tubes that we're playing with. One is a CCFL device that's used to illuminate a flat panel display in a laptop. We tried that one. That's very interesting. You can really see the amplitude of the voltage as you slide the tube up and down the the element. At the top, of course, at the end of the element, is very, very wide lighting, and at the bottom, it's very narrow. Similarly, with an 18T3, you can see that it's brighter at the top, and it's 18T12, whatever it was. It was just a standard fluorescent 12-inch light bulb. At the top, it was very bright. At the bottom, the molecules would excite less bright. This bulb is definitely lighting its filament. When I look at the filament, when we look at the filament right there, at the very bottom, at the current loop, with one leg attached, you can see the filament lighting very dimly. You can see it very clearly. You can see the curls in it, the whole bit. As you move it up to the middle, it gets very, very bright. You can see the filament itself. And again, you can even see the filament more clearly at the top because it's kind of a medium brightness. And you can see the actual outline. You can actually see the curls on the filament. So kind of an interesting thing. So,
repeater, timeout.
Bob, on that transmission, you timed out the machine for a full 60 seconds. So we have to watch our watch, fellas. And I was hearing you on the input, so I was hearing everything you were saying. And Bob was describing how mysterious it is that there's only one contact being made, and it's really the filament lighting. I also didn't mention the fact that down at the base of this ground plane antenna, he was getting a dim lighting. Two-thirds of the way or so up on the actual radiator, the quarter-wave radiator, he was getting an intense amount of lighting of that 18 Tango 3 light bulb. When he brought it up to the very tip, he got slightly dimmer lighting. And if the light bulb wasn't there, and if you were able to plot the voltage across that radiator when you're transmitting into it, I'm coming up to 1 minute, so I'm going to drop.
Hey, Dick, how about the other side of the pole? You may have a length of wire that's acting as a stump if we pick it up.
Yeah, good suggestion there, Howie.
Chrome on the open end.
Yeah, he did say the word clip lead. So we're going to have to hear a little bit about that. But the natural radiator of the ground plane antenna, without anything near it, has maximum voltage at the far tip and minimum voltage at the bottom. It's a little bit of a half of a seesaw-like phenomenon. It's actually a fraction of a sine wave, so to speak, in amplitude versus position. The crossover of the sine wave is at the base, and the peak of the first quarter cycle of the sine wave is up at the tip. I have 15 seconds to go here. That's the highest voltage at the bottom, at the top, when the radiator is undisturbed. When you put your light bulb in hand near the tip of the antenna, that's where the voltage is the highest. That's where it's most sensitive to strain capacitance. Let me drop. And as such, because you detuned the antenna, you lowered the voltage at that point, and the light bulb is not quite as brilliant. Whereas when you're approximately one-third of the way up on the antenna, where the voltage is not quite as high, but it's a better impedance match into the way you were touching that light bulb with your hand on the other side of the light bulb, the capacitance of your hand and the grounding to the rest of the universe does complete the circuit. An RF circuit, in fact, an end-fed ZEP antenna, if you think about it, Bob, you're feeding one end of the antenna with reference to ground. Only one wire, only one RF connection takes place with an end-fed ZEP antenna. It really is a half-wave antenna where you're feeding it at the open end. As you guys have heard me say many times, there's nothing magic about feeding a dipole in the dead center. If you've got the right kind of a balancing device, you can feed it center, one quarter of the way from center, half away from center, three quarters of the way away from center, or the outer tip. And an end-fed ZEP does that. So the way RF finds ground in 20 places, one single wire of contact to an RF device is quite often sufficient. Let me drop.
That extra lead is acting to pick up the current, and if you have a bolt, it's going to induce a current.
Yeah, I did.
It's a very short lead on that bulb, and that's really not just going to work on current.
I do want to know, Bob, whether or not a clip lead was involved, or were you just holding the light bulb in your fingers when you were making contact to one terminal of the bayonet base of the light bulb? And also, out of curiosity, did it make a difference if the portion of the antenna you touched was the center tip of the bayonet contact socket, or was it the outer metal shell, or was there a difference when you did that? And by the way, is there a way, Bob, that you can, with your photographic equipment, take a close-up photograph of the light bulb lit with Jesse holding it in his hand against the antenna, take a close-up photograph and send that picture to me? Is there any chance you could do that, Bob? I'd love to see it. W2EEO, wait for the full drop, K2RIW.
And turn in with a question.
question is recognized. I didn't get the call. Yes, I can take a picture. I can email it to you. The email address on QRZ, I would imagine, is okay. Let me know if it is not. Okay. It doesn't matter which way the bulb is facing. In other words, whether we're clipping the shell or the tip, it does exactly the same thing. We never had our hand on the apparatus. So we clip the bulb, stand back, see down, observe, move the bulb. So we never put our hands anywhere near. We were always, you know, standing away from the antenna. So we were actually performing our test. Back to you, Dick, and just let me know if that's your address on QRZ.
Yes. My call letters at arrl.net. The call letters on QRZ. Lots of call letters you can get to me. No sweat on that one. All right, so your hand is not involved. Alex recognized. We're going to go to Alex in a minute. You said you clipped the bulb either to the tip or the body of the bayonet, and you clipped to the antenna. Describe the contact. Was this a very short piece of back-to-back alligator clip where one end of the alligator clip was on the antenna and the other end was on the light bulb? So no hand was involved. How were you suspending the light bulb at the point of contact on the antenna? Be a little careful about the timing out, Bob. Over to you, Bob. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Back to the puzzlement that I had for 20, 30 years or so. Why is the umbrella there? Let me drop again. Question is not how it is formed and how it is created by the antenna and all of that. Probably going too much, so the questions will actually will allow us to understand why the hole in the donut exists. Now, how the donut is created, but my question is why it is there. Mother Nature does not do anything about without a good reason. So, Dick, perhaps you have an answer. Why is the hole in the donut around the antenna? And two and any.
Fascinating question. Okay. A dipole-like antenna always radiates broadside. So if I've got a dipole in my backyard, it's strung out in the backyard east to west. It is sending the strongest signal north and south. However, if I was rotating the dipole and measuring its antenna pattern, I would only be looking at one plane of its radiation. You could say, I'm looking at the equatorial plane. In reality, that dipole in my backyard from east to west, if the dirt in the backyard was not there, it's not only radiating broadside to the north and the south, with equal amplitude, it's radiating straight up and straight down, broadside to that wire. You plot the total pattern. Let me drop. You plot the total pattern of that antenna up, down, north, south, and everything in between. You'll get that amplitude versus angle where the signal goes to zero off the tips of the dipole and it's maximum broadside, and that's in three-dimensional space around that wire. I could look at this now. I was going to say cucumber. Cucumber doesn't fit. That is a donut. Because of the way we plot antenna patterns, where the antenna pattern goes to zero in amplitude, we bring the strip chart recorder pen down to the base, so to speak. And so, in theory, you could make yourself a kind of a strip chart recorder which operates on a spherical surface. Let me drop. And that beautiful French-main machine called Satimo, S-A-T-I-M-O. You look that up on the internet, and you'll see this beautiful machine that plots three-dimensional patterns of antennas for you in very rapid time. And quite often you get a pattern that looks like a bumpy apple, but you could, in theory, make yourself a three-dimensional plotting machine which starts off with a spherical surface like your globe, and where the antenna pattern is strong, you put the tip of a mountain, and where the pattern is weak, you put the valley at the bottom of the sea, if you know what I mean. You fill up your whole sphere, your whole globe, with this three-dimensional antenna pattern, and it will draw out a donut. Because depending on how you set that wire, if I set the wire in such a way that the wire on my globe was going between the North Pole and the South Pole, let me drop, I would get the strongest signal around the equator of that globe. Everywhere where there's an equator, I would have maximum signal strength. At the North Pole and the South Pole, the far field radiation would be minimum. You don't radiate off the tips of a straight, flat piece of wire dipole. At the plus and minus 10 degree latitude points, the signal would be a little weaker. At the 45 degree plus and minus latitude points, it would be a little bit weaker yet. At the Arctic Circle and the Antarctic Circle, it would be extremely weak, and you'd eventually be drawing out that three-dimensional donut pattern. So it's just the fact that the dipole in three-dimensional space always radiates broadside to its wire. And I know that doesn't completely make sense yet, but at least it's the beginning of the explanation, Alex. Good question. N2NNU, K2RIW. Make sure you wait for the drop.
I lost you about 30 seconds after you started speaking, Dick. Let's take that dipole in free air. This has an radiation pattern like an 8 broadside to it. If you bury that, one of the elements of the dipole into the ground, you get the monopole. When you are plotting the current through the monopole, you can see that the current is much more at the middle of the monopole, and the minimum at its end, at the beginning and the end. Drop. So the most powerful radiation comes up from the middle of the dipole, of the one element that remains above the ground. Now, why don't I see it 10 meters away? Why do I see it 20 meters away, for example? This is the question. Why? It's not how, it's why. Why did the Mother Nature consider that that is necessary?
Okay, if I took that donut pattern that I made by plotting on the surface of that sphere, mountains and valleys representing the single strand in that direction of three-dimensional space. And I got that donut pattern, and now I take a knife and slice right through the sphere. I slice from the north pole toward the south pole, and I've oriented the knife so I'm cutting through the prime meridian and also the international date line. I will trace out a figure eight. You said monopole. And you said current is maximum in the center. This is a bit of a problem now. Let me drop. A ordinary monopole antenna operating against a counterpoise that's a very large ground plane is a quarter wavelength long. Yes, you could make a monopole half wave long. Very few people do that. It'd be sort of a J-pole antenna, half wave long. And that would have, whether the wire is quarter wave long or half wave long, maximum radiation is broadside to that wire. And if it's a quarter wave long, the maximum current is at the base, minimum current is at the top. The current flowing through the wire, by right-hand rule, creates a magnetic field flowing around the wire, similar to your fingers curling on a piece of wire and your thumb is in the direction of the current flow. That launches the signal. That piece of wire in my hand, my thumb is pointing in the direction of the current flow, my fingers wrapped around the wire, show me where the magnetic field coming out of the wire is. Let me drop. And it's kind of obvious that because that magnetic field is flowing in all directions around that wire is radiating that magnetic field at right angles to the wire in all directions. That gives you a little bit of an idea that the wire doesn't just radiate in the plane that you've decided to plot the antenna pattern. You can take a planar cut through the antenna pattern. Every antenna you and I have ever touched has a three-dimensional pattern because of the instrumentation we use, because we only care about the signal that goes out to the horizon to talk to our buddies in Europe, for instance. We only look at a slice of that pattern, but the three-dimensional pattern is there. In general, with antennas that are a half wave long or less, the majority of the radiation is broadside to the wire in all directions in space, and there's a null in the pattern off the tips of the wire. Doesn't matter if it's a monopole, quarter wave ground plane, J-pole, half wave, they all fulfill that requirement. You said why. I think what I said is the current flowing with my thumb and my fingers wrapping around the wire showing where the magnetic field comes from. That is the beginning of the radiation process. Let me drop one more time. The hard thing for us to believe...
2 meter. Transmit.
The hard thing for us to believe is that when our antenna is transmitting a signal, for the most part, not a single electron leaves the antenna. The electron, or the cloud of electrons, represents a cloud of charge that bounces back and forth on the antenna, somewhat similar to your daughter swinging back and forth on the swing in the backyard. In either cases, it's a resonating circuit. that current flowing back and forth creates a magnetic field. The magnetic field is what begins the radiation process. You take apart any of the antenna modeling programs, the very first step it does is to carefully calculate where the current is flowing in every 16th of an inch of the wire of your antenna, so to speak, and then adds up all of those magnetic fields from all of those currents from all those little bitty sections. So it's the current flowing through the wire creating the magnetic field. The magnetic field is at right angles to the wire wrapping around it that begins the radiation process in all directions perpendicular to the wire. N2NNU. Wait for the beep. K2LIW. And by the way, your timing of 30 seconds was exactly right.
2HWW. Dick, can I get in here for a minute, please?
Sure, beep, I guess. N2NNU. Go ahead, please.
Go ahead, Howie.
Wait, I'm hearing stuff back here in Connecticut. I just want to make a comment with the bulb problem before I finish up on close remote base. Number one, if you have a piece of wire, any length on the other wire, that bulb is going to pick up the inductively picked up current. If there was no lead, you would have to have a contact, and the lamp should only work with current. But in this case, if it's lighting at the ends or at the middle, that's telling you that there's some length of wire that's acting like an antenna, and you got a lot of coupling. Go ahead. That's all I was trying to say.
Yeah, I hear you, and I disagree. It is my guess that Bob could have made that clip read as short as possible. He could have, if he wanted to, assuming he's willing to sacrifice that light bulb, he could have taken the little tiny tip of the light bulb and directly solder it to the wire of the radiating antenna, and he would have gotten the exact same illumination. So it's not the length of the wire being a pickup device, in my opinion. It's the presence of the local RF field across the bulb that's causing the lighting of the gas in the bulb, is my guess. I'm looking forward to that photograph he's going to be mailing me. So, when it comes to the current flow, now back to Alex, when it comes to the current flowing in the wire, and by right-hand rule, your fingers wrapped around, launching that magnetic field, that's what begins the radiation process, in my opinion. I wonder if that helps a little bit, Alex. N2NNU, wait for the beep, I mean the full drop, K2LIW.
Had that issue happen. I've done that experiment before.
Yeah, the issue with the light bulb is just keep it in your hand, transmit with 1 kilowatt, and you will see the light bulb just bright, very bright, very bright, very nice. Very nice tuning circuit. A very simple neon light, without light or without lid, without nothing, it will probably light in your hand at a level of 500, 600 watts. Let me drop it. Okay. Well, Dick, I'm not sure. You know, I take my field meter, field strength meter, going next to my antenna, my vertical, measure something, going a little bit further, measure a little bit less, a little less, a little less, a little less.